When the Thebans, trusting in the alliance of the Eacidae, made an attempt and were roughly handled by the Athenians, the Thebans sent again and gave the Eacidae back to them, but asked instead for the men themselves. The Aeginetans, elated by their great prosperity and recalling an old enmity toward the Athenians, then, at the Thebans' request, waged an undeclared war on the Athenians. For while the Athenians were occupied with the Boeotians, the Aeginetans sailed with warships against Attica and sacked Phalerum, and along the rest of the coast, many villages, and by doing this, did great harm to the Athenians. This enmity that the Aeginetans owed the Athenians from before had its origin as follows. For the Epidaurians, their land yielded no crop. Concerning this misfortune, the Epidaurians consulted the oracle at Delphi. The Pythia bade them set up statues of Damia and Oxesia, and told them that things would go better for them if they did so. The Epidaurians then asked whether they should make the statues of bronze or of stone. The Pythia allowed neither of these, but said they should be made of the wood of the cultivated olive. So the Epidaurians asked the Athenians to give them an olive tree to cut, considering the Athenian olives to be the most sacred. It is said, too, that at that time there were no olive trees anywhere else in the world, except at Athens. The Athenians said they would give it on these terms, that the Epidaurians should bring yearly offerings to Athena Polias and to Erechtheus. The Epidaurians agreed to this and got what they asked for, and having made statues from these olive trees they set them up, and their land bore crops, and they fulfilled toward the Athenians what they had agreed. Up to this time, and even before it, the Aeginetans were subject to the Epidaurians in other respects and also crossed over to Epidaurus for their lawsuits, giving and receiving judgment from one another there. But from this point on they built ships and, acting willfully, revolted from the Epidaurians. Being now at odds with them, and being masters of the sea, they harassed them, and indeed they carried off these very statues of Damia and Oxesia from them, and brought them and set them up in their own territory, in the interior, in a place called Ea, about 20 stadia from the city. Having set them up in this place, they propitiated them with sacrifices and with women's choruses full of mockery, 10 men being appointed as chorus leaders for each of the two deities, and the choruses spoke ill of no man, but only of the local women. The Epidaurians, too, had the same sacred rites, and they have secret rites as well. When these statues were stolen, the Epidaurians stopped fulfilling toward the Athenians what they had agreed. The Athenians sent in anger to the Epidaurians, but they replied that they were doing no wrong. For as long as they had had the statues in their land, they had fulfilled what they had agreed. But now that the statues had been taken from them, it was no longer fair for them to keep paying. But they told the Athenians to demand payment from the Aeginetans who now held them. In response to this, the Athenians sent to Aegina and demanded the statues back. But the Aeginetans said they had no dealings whatsoever with the Athenians. The Athenians say that after this demand, a single trireme was sent out carrying certain of their citizens, who, being sent on behalf of the state and arriving at Aegina, tried to tear these statues, as being made of their own wood, up out of their bases, so as to carry them off. Not being able to overpower them in this way, they threw ropes around them and tried to drag the statues off. And as they were dragging them, a thunderclap occurred, and along with the thunderclap, an earthquake. And the sailors of the trireme who were hauling on the ropes, affected by this, lost their senses, and in this state killed one another as though they were enemies, until at last only one was left of them all, and he made his way back to Phalerum. This is how the Athenians say it happened, but the Aeginetans say the Athenians did not come in a single ship. For a single ship, or a small number beyond that, they could have driven off without difficulty, even lacking ships of their own. But they say a great many ships sailed against their land, and that they themselves gave way and avoided a naval engagement. On this point, they cannot say for certain whether it was, because they recognized themselves inferior in a sea fight, that they gave way on this account, or because they wished to do something like what they in fact did. As for the Athenians, when no one came out to fight them, they say they disembarked from their ships and turned to the statues, and being unable to tear them up out of their bases, they thereupon threw ropes around them and dragged them, until, as they were being dragged, both statues did the same thing, though to me this seems incredible, even if to someone else it may not. For they fell upon their knees to fall, and that ever since that time he had remained in this condition. That is what the Athenians say happened. But the Aeginetans say that when the Athenians learned that they were about to campaign against them, they made the Argives ready to help. So when the Athenians had landed on Aegina, the Argives came to their aid, having crossed over from Epidaurus to the island without being noticed, and before the Athenians had any warning, they fell upon them, cutting them off from their ships. And at that same moment, there came a thunderclap and an earthquake upon them. This, then, is what is said by the Argives and the Aeginetans, and it is agreed even by the Athenians that only one of their men got back safely to Attica. Except that the Argives say it was because the Argives destroyed the Attic force that this one man survived, while the Athenians say it was through divine action. Yet not even this one man survived, they say, but perished in the following manner. Once he was brought back to Athens, he reported the disaster. And when the wives of the men who had campaigned against Aegina learned of it, they were furious that he alone of all the men should have been saved. And surrounding the man, they stabbed him with the pins of their garments, each of them asking him where her own husband was. And so, this man was killed in this way, and to the Athenians, the deed of the women seemed to be a thing even more terrible than the disaster itself. Not having any other way to punish the women, they changed their dress to the Ionian style. For before this, the women of Athens had worn Dorian dress, very similar to that of Corinth. So they changed it to the linen tunic, so that they would have no need of pins. In truth, if one is speaking accurately, this dress was not originally Ionian, but Carian, since all the ancient Greek dress for women was the same as what we now call Dorian. As for the Argives and the Aeginetans, in addition to this, they also made it a law among themselves in each case that their pins should be made half again, as long as the measure then in use, and that women should dedicate pins above all else in the temple of these goddesses, and that nothing of Attic manufacture should be brought to the temple, not even pottery, but that henceforth it should be the custom there to drink from local vessels only. And so from that time to this day, the women of Argos and Aegina, on account of this quarrel with the Athenians, have worn pins larger than before. This was the beginning of the hostility toward the Aeginetans arising from the Athenians, as has been described. Now, when the Thebans made their appeal, remembering eagerly the affair of the statues, the Aeginetans came to the aid of the Boeotians. The Aeginetans ravaged the coastal parts of Attica, and when the Athenians set out to campaign against Aegina, an oracle came from Delphi telling them to hold off from retaliation against the Aeginetans' wrongdoing for 30 years. And in the 31st year, having dedicated a precinct to Aeacus, to begin the war against the Aeginetans, and things would go as they wished. But if they campaigned at once, they would suffer much and do much in the meantime, but in the end would subdue them. When the Athenians heard this report brought back, they dedicated the precinct to Aeacus, which now stands on the Agora, but they could not endure hearing that they must wait 30 years, having suffered such outrageous treatment from the Aeginetans. But while they were preparing for revenge, a matter arising from the Lacedaemonians became an obstacle. For the Lacedaemonians, learning of the scheme devised by the Alcmaeonids against the Pythia, and what the Pythia had contrived against themselves and the Pisistratids, felt it a double misfortune, that they had driven out men who were their guest friends from that man's land, and that after doing this, they received no gratitude from the Athenians. Moreover, beyond this, the oracles urged them on, declaring that many hostile things would come to them from the Athenians, oracles of which they had previously been ignorant, but which they had now learned in full, since Cleomenes had brought them to Sparta. Cleomenes had acquired these oracles from the Athenian Acropolis, which the Pisistratids had previously possessed, but had abandoned in the shrine when driven into exile, and Cleomenes recovered what had been left behind. So then, when the Lacedaemonians had recovered the oracles and saw the Athenians growing in power and by no means willing to obey them, they reasoned that the Attic people, if free, would become a match for their own power, but that if held down under tyranny, it would be weak and ready to be ruled. Having grasped each of these points, they sent for Hippias, son of Pisistratus, from Sigeum on the Hellespont, where the Pisistratids had taken refuge. When Hippias came at their summons, the Spartans, having also summoned messengers from their other allies, spoke to them as follows: "Allied men, we acknowledge that we ourselves did not act rightly. Stirred up by counterfeit oracles, we drove out men who were our closest guest friends and who had undertaken to deliver Athens into our hands. We drove them from their homeland, and then, having done this, we handed the city over to an ungrateful people, who, once freed through us and having lifted up its head, drove us out along with our king in the most insolent manner. And having grown a reputation, now increases in power, so that the neighboring peoples, above all the Boeotians and Chalcidians, have learned this to their cost, and perhaps someone else too will learn it by making the same mistake. Since we erred in doing what we did, we shall now try, coming together with you, to take revenge upon them. For this very reason we have summoned this man Hippias, and you from your cities, so that with a common plan and a common expedition, we may bring him into Athens and restore to him what we took away. So they spoke, but the majority of the allies were unwilling to accept these words. Most of them kept silent, but Socles of Corinth spoke as follows. Socles, speaking as ambassador from Corinth, said these things, and Hippias answered him, calling upon the same gods as Socles had, saying that indeed the Corinthians of all people would most long for the Pisistratids, whenever their appointed days came for them to be vexed by the Athenians. Hippias answered in this way, as one who knew the oracles most accurately of all men. But the rest of the allies, who up to that point had kept themselves quiet, once they heard Socles speak freely, each of them broke silence and took the side of the Corinthians' opinion, and they charged the Lacedaemonians solemnly to do nothing new against a Greek city. Thus this matter was stopped. And as Hippias was driven away from there, Amyntas king of the Macedonians offered him Anthemus, and the Thessalians offered him Iolcus. But he chose neither of these, and withdrew instead back to Sigeum, which Pisistratus had taken by the spear from the Mytileneans, and having gained control of it had established as tyrant there his own bastard son Hegesistratus, born of an Argive woman, who did not hold without a fight what he had received from Pisistratus. For the Mytileneans and the Athenians made war for a long time, the former setting out from the city of Achilleum, and the latter from Sigeum, the Mytileneans demanding the return of the territory, while the Athenians neither conceded the point nor accepted it, arguing by reasoning that the Aeolians had no more claim to the territory of the Iliad than they themselves, and all the other Greeks who had joined with Menelaus in avenging the abduction of Helen. As they made war, all sorts of other things happened in their battles, and in one of these the poet Alcaeus, when a battle took place and the Athenians were winning, himself fled and escaped, but the Athenians took his arms and hung them up in the temple of Athena at Sigeum. Alcaeus composed a poem about this and sent it to Mytilene, announcing his own misfortune to his comrade Melanippus. Periander, son of Cypselus, reconciled the Mytileneans and the Athenians, for to him they submitted the matter as arbiter. He reconciled them in this way, that each side should keep what it then held. Thus Sigeum came under the Athenians. Now when Hippias arrived in Asia from Laestamon, he set every wheel in motion, slandering the Athenians to art of friends, and doing everything he could so that Athens might come under his own power and that of Darius. Hippias was carrying out these plans, and the Athenians, learning of this, sent messengers to Sardis, urging the Persians not to trust the Athenian exiles. Artaphernes told them that, if they wished to be safe, they should take Hippias back. Now the Athenians would not accept these words as reported, and having refused them, they resolved to be openly at war with the Persians. It was while they held this view, having already fallen under suspicion with the Persians, that at this very time Aristagoras of Miletus, having been driven out of Sparta by Cleomenes the Lacedaemonian, arrived at Athens, for this city held the greatest power of the rest. Coming before the assembly, Aristagoras said the same things he had said at Sparta about the good things to be found in Asia and about the war with Persia, how the Persians had no use of shield or spear and would be easy to conquer. This is what he said, and in addition to this, he also said that the Milesians were colonists of the Athenians, and that it was fitting that the Athenians, being powerful, should rescue them. And there was nothing he did not promise, in his great need, until he persuaded them. It seems that deceiving a crowd is simpler than deceiving one man, since he was unable to deceive Cleomenes the Lacedaemonian alone, yet he managed to do this to 30,000 Athenians. So the Athenians, persuaded, voted to send 20 ships to help the Ionians, appointing as their commander Melanthius, a citizen held in the highest regard in every respect. These ships were the beginning of troubles for both Greeks and barbarians. Aristagoras sailed on ahead and arrived at Miletus, and having devised a plan from which no benefit at all was going to come to the Ionians, nor indeed did he do it for their sake, but only in order to trouble King Darius. He sent a man into Phrygia to the Paeonians, who had been taken captive by Megabazus from the river Strymon and were living in Phrygia in a district and village of their own. When this man arrived among the Paeonians, he said the following, "Men, Paeonians, Aristagoras the tyrant of Miletus has sent me to advise you of a way to safety, if indeed you are willing to follow it. All Ionia has now revolted from the king, and it is open to you to save yourselves and return to your own land. As far as the sea, the matter is yours to manage. From there on, it will be our concern." Hearing this, the Paeonians were very glad, and taking their children and wives, they fled toward the sea, though some of them stayed behind out of fear. When the Paeonians reached the sea, they crossed from there to Chios. While they were already on Chios, a large force of Persian cavalry had come on their heels, pursuing them. When it failed to overtake them, it sent word to Chios demanding that the Paeonians be sent back. But the Paeonians would not agree to this. Instead, the Chians carried them from Chios over to Lesbos, and from there the Lesbians took them on to Doriscus, from where they made their way on foot and arrived in Paeonia. As for Aristagoras, once 20 Athenian ships had reached him, bringing along 5 triremes of Eretrians, who campaigned not as a favor to the Athenians, but to the Milesians themselves, repaying a debt they owed them. For the Milesians earlier had shared with the Eretrians in the war against the Chalcidians, at the time when the Samians had come to the aid of the Chalcidians against the Eretrians and Milesians. Once these allies had arrived along with the rest of the allied force, Aristagoras organized an expedition against Sardis. He himself did not join the campaign but remained in Miletus, appointing other men as commanders of the Milesians, his own brother Charopinus, and of the citizens, another man, Hermaphantus. Arriving with this expedition, the Ionians came to Ephesus, where they left their ships at Coressus in Ephesian territory, and themselves went up inland with a large force, taking the Ephesians as guides for the way. Traveling along the river Caistor from there, once they had crossed Mount Tmolus, they arrived and took Sardis, with no one opposing them. They took everything except the Acropolis, and the Acropolis was defended by Artaphernes himself, who had no small force of men. What kept them from plundering the city once they had taken it was this. In Sardis, most of the houses were built of reeds, and even those that were of brick had roofs of reed thatch. When one of the soldiers set fire to one of these, the fire spread at once from house to house across the whole city. As the city burned, the Lydians and every Persian who was in it cut off on every side as the fire consumed the outskirts and finding no way out of the city, gathered together in the marketplace and by the river Pactolus, which carries gold dust down from Tmolus and flows through the middle of the marketplace and then empties into the river Hermus, and the Hermus into the sea. Gathering along this Pactolus and in the marketplace, the Lydians and Persians were forced to defend themselves. When the Ionians saw some of the enemy resisting and others advancing against them in great numbers, they grew afraid and withdrew to the mountain called Tmolus, and from there, under cover of night, they made their way back to their ships. And so Sardis was burned, and in it a temple of the native goddess Cybeb, which the Persians later used as their pretext for burning down the temples in Greece in return. At that time, the Persians who held the territories on this side of the river Halys, hearing of these events, gathered together and came to the aid of the Lydians. And when they found that the Ionians were no longer at Sardis, they followed their track and caught up with them at Ephesus. The Ionians drew up against them, but when battle was joined, they were badly defeated. The Persians killed many of them, including men of note, among them Eulcides, commander of the Eretrians, who had won crowns in the games and had been much praised by Simonides of Ceos. Those of them who escaped the battle scattered to their several cities. Such was the outcome of that engagement. Afterward, the Athenians abandoned the Ionians entirely. Though Aristagoras appealed to them repeatedly through messengers, they refused to help them further. Deprived of Athenian alliance, the Ionians, since matters already stood as they did with regard to Darius, nonetheless prepared no less vigorously for the war against the king. Sailing to the Hellespont, they brought Byzantium and all the other cities in that region under their own control, and having sailed out beyond the Hellespont, they won over most of Caria as an ally as well. For Conus too, which had earlier been unwilling to join the alliance, joined them after the burning of Sardis. The Cypriots all joined them of their own accord, except for the Amathusians, for they too had revolted from the Medes in this way. Onesilus, brother of Gorgas, king of the Salaminians and younger than he, was the son of Chersis, son of Cyramus, son of Euelthin. This man had often before urged Gorgas to revolt from the king, and now, when he learned that the Ionians too had revolted, he pressed him all the more insistently. But when he could not persuade Gorgas, Onesilus and his own partisans watched for him to leave the city of the Salaminians and shut him out of the gates. Gorgas, deprived of his city, fled to the Medes, and Onesilus took power in Salamis and tried to persuade all the Cypriots to join the revolt with him. He persuaded all the rest, but the Amathusians were unwilling to obey him, and so he laid siege to them, encamping before their city. Onesilus, then, was besieging Amathus. When word was brought to King Darius that Sardis had been taken and burned by the Athenians and Ionians, and that the man who had led the gathering that had brought this about was Aristagoras of Miletus, it is said that at first, on learning this, he took no account of the Ionians at all, well knowing that they at least would not go unpunished for their revolt, but asked who the Athenians were. And having learned this, he called for his bow, took it, set an arrow to it, and shot it up toward the sky, and as he shot it into the air, he said, "O Zeus, grant that it fall to me to make the Athenians pay." Having said this, he ordered one of his attendants to say to him three times every time his dinner was set before him, "Master, remember the Athenians." Having given this order, he then summoned into his presence Hystiaeus of Miletus, whom Darius had by now been keeping at his court for a long time, and said, "I hear, Hystiaeus, that your deputy, to whom you entrusted Miletus, has done me a mischief. For men whom he brought over from the other continent, and Ionians along with them, who will pay me the penalty for what they have done, these he has persuaded to follow along with those others, and he has robbed me of Sardis. Now then, how does this seem to you to be a good thing, and how was any of this done without your own counsel? Take care that you do not later find yourself held to blame." To this Hystiaeus replied, "King, what a thing you have said, that I should have devised a plan from which any trouble, great or small, was likely to come upon you. What could I gain by seeking to do this, being in want of nothing? I have everything that you yourself have, and I am deemed worthy to be privy to all your counsels. But if my deputy is indeed doing anything such as you describe, be assured that he has done it entirely on his own account. For my part, I do not even accept the report at all, that the Milesians and my deputy are stirring up any trouble against your affairs. But if indeed they are doing something of the kind, and you, O king, have heard of it as it truly is, then understand what a thing you have done in dragging me away from the sea. For it seems the Ionians, once I was out of their sight, have done what they had long desired to do. Whereas, had I been in Ionia, no city would have stirred. Now then, send me as quickly as possible to Ionia, so that I may set all these matters right again for you and deliver into your hands this deputy of Miletus who has contrived all this. And when I have done this according to your wish, I swear by the gods of the king's house that I will not take off the tunic I am wearing until I go down to Ionia and make Sardo, the greatest of islands, pay tribute to you." By saying this, Hystiaeus meant to deceive him, but Darius believed him and let him go, charging him, once he had fulfilled what he had promised, to come back to him at Susa. Meanwhile, the report about Sardis was making its way up to the king, and while Darius, dealt with the matter of the bow, was in conversation with Hystiaeus, and Hystiaeus, released by Darius, was making his way to the sea, during all this time the following was happening. As Onesilus of Salamis was besieging Amathus, word was brought to him that Artibius, a Persian, was expected to arrive in Cyprus bringing a large Persian force by ship. On learning this, Onesilus sent heralds through Ionia calling on them for help, and the Ionians, after brief deliberation, came with a large fleet. The Ionians duly arrived in Cyprus, and the Persians, having crossed by ship from Cilicia, marched against Salamis by land, while the Phoenicians with their ships sailed around the headland of Cyprus called the Keys. This being so, the tyrants of Cyprus, calling together the commanders of the Ionians, said to them, "Men of Ionia, we Cypriots give you the choice which of the two you wish to engage, the Persians or the Phoenicians. If you wish to be drawn up on land to try your strength against the Persians, now is the time to leave your ships and take up positions on land, while we board your ships to contend against the Phoenicians. But if you would rather try your strength against the Phoenicians, you must do whichever of these you choose, so that, as far as it lies with you, both Ionia and Cyprus may be free." To this the Ionians replied, "It was the common council of the Ionians that sent us to guard the sea, not so that we should hand our ships over to the Cypriots and ourselves engage the Persians on land. We, then, will try to prove ourselves worthy in the position to which we were assigned. As for you, you must remember what you suffered as slaves under the Medes to become good men." This is how the Ionians answered them. Afterward, once the Persians had reached the plain of Salamis, the Cyprian kings arrayed their forces, arraying the rest of the Cyprians opposite the rest of the enemy's soldiers, but selecting the best of the Salaminians and Solians, they arrayed them against the Persians, and against Artibius, the general of the Persians, Onesilus arrayed himself as a volunteer. Artibius rode a horse trained to stand on its hind legs and attack a hoplite. Onesilus, learning of this, for he had a shield-bearer who was Carian by birth, very distinguished in war and otherwise full of spirit, said to him, "I hear that Artibius's horse rears up and strikes with both feet and mouth against whomever it is brought against. So consider and tell me at once which of the two you wish to watch for and strike, the horse or Artibius himself." His attendant answered him thus, "My king, either task suits me, both together or just one, whatever you order I am ready for it, but I will tell you what seems to me more fitting to your position. I say that a king and a general ought to engage a king and a general. For if you bring down the general, that is a great thing for you, and second, if he brings you down, may it not happen, being killed by a worthy man is half a misfortune, while it is fitting for us attendants to engage other attendants, and the horse as well. As for its tricks, have no fear at all, for I promise you it will never again rear up against any man." Having said this, immediately the armies engaged, both by land and by sea. By sea the Ionians proved themselves supreme that day and overcame the Phoenicians, and among them the Samians distinguished themselves most. By land, when the armies met, they fell upon each other and fought. As for the two generals, this is what happened. As Artibius, mounted on his horse, bore down upon Onesilus, Onesilus, according to what he had agreed with his shield-bearer, struck at Artibius himself as he came on. And when the horse set its feet upon Onesilus's shield, the Carian struck with his sickle and lopped off the horse's feet. So Artibius, the general of the Persians, fell there together with his horse. While the others two were fighting, Stesenor, who was tyrant of Curium, betrayed his side, having with him no small force of men. These Curians are said to be colonists of the Argives. When the Curians had betrayed them, at once the war chariots of the Salaminians did the same as the Curians had done. When this happened, the Persians got the upper hand over the Cyprians. When the army was routed, many others fell, and among them Onesilus son of Chersis, the man responsible for stirring up the Cyprian revolt, and Aristosippus son of Philisippus, king of the Solians. This Philisippus was praised in verse above all other tyrants by Solon the Athenian during his visit to Cyprus. As for Onesilus, the Amathusians, because he had besieged them, cut off his head and carried it to Amathus and hung it up above the gates. And when the head, now hollow, had been hanging there, a swarm of bees entered it and filled it with honeycomb. When this had happened, the Amathusians, since they consulted an oracle about the head, were told to take it down and bury it, and to sacrifice to Onesilus every year as to a hero, and that if they did this, things would go better for them. So the Amathusians did this down to my own time. As for the Ionians who had fought at sea off Cyprus, when they learned that Onesilus's cause had been destroyed, and that the cities of the Cyprians were all under siege except Salamis, and that the Salaminians had handed that one over to Gorgas, their former king, the Ionians, learning this at once, sailed away back to Ionia. Of the cities in Cyprus, the one that held out longest under siege was Soli. Digging tunnels under the surrounding wall, the Persians captured it in its fifth month. So the Cyprians, having been free for 1 year, were once again enslaved. Dorizes, husband to one of Darius's daughters, along with Hymes and Otanes, other Persian generals also married to daughters of Darius, pursued those of the Ionians who had marched against Sardis and drove them back onto their ships, and having thus prevailed in the battle, from then on they divided up the cities among themselves and sacked them. Dorizes turned toward the cities on the Hellespont and took Dardanus. He took Abydos too, and Percote, and Lampsacus, and Pisus. These he captured one on each day. But as he was marching from Pisus against the city of Parium, news came to him that the Carians, of the same mind as the Ionians, had revolted from the Persians. So he turned back from the Hellespont and led his army against Caria. Somehow this was reported to the Carians before Dorizes arrived, and when the Carians learned of it, they gathered at the place called the White Pillars, near the river Marsyas, a stream that rises in the region of Idrias and pours into the Maeander. When the Carians had assembled there, many plans were proposed, but the best one, in my opinion, was that of Pixidarus, son of Mausolus, a man of Sindai, who had married the daughter of Cyanesis, king of the Cilicians. This man's proposal was that the Carians should cross the Maeander and fight with the river at their backs, so that the Carians, having no way to retreat, would be forced to stand their ground and thus become even braver than their nature. But this proposal did not prevail. Instead, they decided that the Maeander should be at the Persians' backs rather than their own, evidently so that if the Persians were put to flight and defeated in the battle, they would not be able to escape home, but would fall into the river. Afterward, when the Persians had arrived and crossed the Maeander, there on the river Marsyas, the Carians engaged the Persians and fought a fierce battle for a long time, but in the end they were defeated by sheer numbers. Of the Persians, about 2,000 men fell, of the Carians about 10,000. Those of them who escaped from there were driven together into Labronda, into the sanctuary of Zeus Stratius, a great and holy grove of plane trees. The Carians are the only people we know of who offer sacrifices to Zeus Stratius. Having been driven together there, they deliberated about their safety, whether it would be better for them to surrender themselves to the Persians or to abandon Asia altogether. While they were deliberating on this, the Milesians and their allies arrived to help them. Then the Carians abandoned the plans they had been considering before, and instead prepared to make war again from the beginning. When the Persians advanced, they engaged them, and in the fighting they were defeated even more badly than before, and of all who fell, the Milesians suffered the heaviest losses. After this defeat, however, the Carians recovered and fought back. For learning that the Persians had set out to march against their cities, they set an ambush along the road near Pedasus, and the Persians, falling into it at night, were destroyed. Both the soldiers themselves and their generals Dorizes, Amorges, and Sisymuses. Along with them died Miasis, son of Gyges, as well. The leader of this ambush was Heraclides, son of Ibanoles, a man of Mylasa. These were the Persians destroyed in this way. As for Hymes, he too had been among those pursuing the Ionians who had marched against Sardis, and turning toward the Propontis he took Chus in Mysia. And having taken this, when he learned that Dorizes had abandoned the Hellespont to march on Caria, he in turn abandoned the Propontis, marched his army toward the Hellespont, and took all the Aeolians who occupy the Troad, and he took the Gergithians, the remnant of the ancient Teucrians. But Hymes himself, while capturing these peoples, died of disease in the Troad. Thus he met his end. Meanwhile Artaphernes, the governor of Sardis, and Otanes, the third general, were appointed to make war against Ionia and the neighboring Aeoles. In Ionia they took Clazomenae, and among the Aeolians Syme. As the cities were being taken, Aristagoras of Miletus proved, as it turned out, to be a man of no great spirit. For having thrown Ionia into turmoil and stirred up great troubles, he began, seeing how things stood, to plan flight. Moreover, it seemed to him impossible to overcome King Darius. In view of this, he called together his fellow conspirators and took counsel, saying it would be better for them to have some place of refuge ready, in case they should be driven out of Miletus, whether he should lead them from there to Sardo to found a colony, or to Miasinus of the Adonians, which Hystiaeus had fortified after receiving it as a gift from Darius. This is what Aristagoras asked. Hecateus, son of Hegesander, a writer of accounts, advised that they should go to neither of these places, but should build a fortress on the island of Leros and remain quiet there if they were driven out of Miletus. And afterward, setting out from there, they could return to Miletus. This is what Hecateus advised, but Aristagoras himself was most inclined to lead them off to Myasinus. So he entrusted Miletus to Pythagoras, a man of good standing among the citizens, and he himself, taking with him whoever wished to go, sailed to Thrace, and took possession of the region for which he had set out. But setting out from there, Aristagoras himself and his army were destroyed by the Thracians, while he was besieging a city, even though the Thracians were willing to come out under a truce.